Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Shadow King to my Shadow Man, it's Dan.
Good morning, Scott. I'm ready to have another, or inflict more Legionnaire's disease on our STD-craving listeners.
I love that we have a name that our anagram sounds like we're a sexually transmitted disease to begin with. So it's just right that we refer to it as Legionnaire's disease. Before even going any further, I feel it's incumbent upon me to explain that little reference I made in the intro this week. Because that might have been, I'm guessing that would be lost on most listeners or most anyone, quite frankly. We've already mentioned that we think that the creature, based on something you thought of a few weeks ago, is probably the quote-unquote Shadow King from Marvel Comics. I imagine people are wondering, okay, I know what the Shadow King is, but what the hell is the Shadow Man? Where that comes from, where I dug that out of, is that's from the first season of the Twilight Zone revival that was done back in the 1980s. Just telling y'all, there was a segment that was called The Shadow Man that was actually directed by Mr. Gremlins himself, Joe Dante. It's a seriously great little story with a really neat, creepy twist to it. So guess what? Anyone who actually wants to check that out, you can find it on YouTube. So maybe after you're finished with this podcast or some point later on, just go on YouTube and type in the words The Twilight Zone 1X23 The Shadow Man, and you'll get the entire episode there. It's very 80s. But it's really a lot of fun. It's really, it's got a neat little kick to it. It's definitely one of the most memorable new Twilight Zone episodes that they ever did.
Sweet.
And, you know, in the spirit and speaking of fun, we are, of course, back, as you just mentioned a moment ago, to talk about what's probably been one of the most fun TV experiences we've had over the past year, and that would be the FX series Legion. Especially this past episode, good lord. Now, before we, how shall I put it, delve into that cauldron of weird that was Chapter 6, once again, let's first backtrack to the previous chapter for a few minutes with more thoughts on last week's episode. Now, looking back on Chapter 5, i.e. rewatching it, I made note of the fact that Sid never actually gets to tell David what they discovered about him. When she first starts, he actually cuts her off, you know, to say the whole, I know what I am, and then the whole magic man taking Sid to the white room by the beach happens, or in their minds, I guess. And Melanie even brings it up to her later, but the whole time Sid never seems all that concerned about it as much as she should be. Melanie is actually the first person to express any concerns over the way David has changed since his return. So it's just kind of interesting that Sid, who tends to be the most aware or cognizant person on the show, almost is deliberately not for at least a good chunk of that episode, I noticed.
Yeah, she definitely was exhibiting the classic, like,
rose-colored glasses or something?
Over that last week. More obvious.
I think your audio went in and out a little bit there, so I missed part of what you said, just so you're aware of it.
At least something is.
Oh, boy. Anyway, I wish I could segue to something that was related to that, but that's not the next thing I have in my mind. I was wondering, even though I think something that happens in the current episode kind of clues me in a little bit. That presence of the bug-infested strawberries, it's to me, I guess it's kind of an indication that there's already a more sinister side of David that may be behind the wheel here, which again begs the question, is when Sid is bedding down with David, is it purely David at that point? Is it partially David and partially the evil side, etc.? I like to hope that it's at least mostly David, or at least partially David. That's my way of looking at it. Do you have any additional thoughts on that before we move on?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, from what we've seen in the episode we're about to discuss, I think it's, you know, it's not really cut and dried. Like, this is like, you know, this is David time. This is like, you know, Lenny time. It seems like it's just a big old, you know, blended together, who knows what. So I think, you know, that's a good assumption that at least David was, you know, somewhat present in whatever that.
I'm going to say that I think it's at least mostly David or a good portion of David until his experience going into the Red Room. I think that's when the more quote-unquote full change happens, if that makes any sense. I don't know if you're talking because I can't hear you, so I'm going to assume you're not. So, then I noticed that shortly thereafter, and just an observation. Sid and David's proximity to each other on the couch when they're talking with Melanie, I don't know, for two people that really are supposed to avoid touching each other, they seem really close together. I kept thinking about how, wow, I keep thinking you could inadvertently brush up against her or touch her because you're like practically on top of one another on the couch. But it's there that we see something I would call his initial apathy, and then it's kind of followed by a very impish approach, especially when he's speaking with Melanie. It's so unlike the way he had been for the previous four episodes. That's why, to a certain degree, it's hard to believe that the Shadow King might not have been in control. But like I was saying, I think it may be less about one side, you know, taking control, and more about, for lack of a better way to put it, percentages. It's kind of like a virus or infection taking over bit by bit, or as Loudermilk later says in the episode, like a parasite. So maybe it's starting to seep in, and it gets further and further as the episode goes on, perhaps. I also thought it was interesting that, speaking of that Red Room, that we see and hear Lenny is tossing the ball against the wall repeatedly, which, you know, the first thing you think of, oh, it's, you know, especially if you're a classic movie fan, oh, it's like Steve McQueen in The Great Escape, throwing a ball against the wall constantly while he's being kept in solitary confinement. It's kind of like Lenny being kept, you know, almost a bit of a prisoner in David's mind to a certain extent. But I think it's more the significance that she's lying in a bathtub. Because a bathtub, I feel, can suggest, you know, the obvious, such as, you know, cleansing, but it's also about rebirth or regeneration, like a baptism. And the fact that the room is bathed in red light, it kind of gives it a feeling as though one is being bathed in blood, which, you know, brings to mind images of ritual, of sacrifice. It's as if the room itself is a staging ground for the evil, which we will see later. Is that, like, profound enough for you? Anyway. So tap your mic to make sure you're working there. What did you think of the fact that they did not release Dr. Kissinger from his cell?
I mean, I think it kind of made sense. I mean, it was kind of weird for them, I suppose. But, I mean, he definitely was acting so unhinged, it probably wouldn't have helped their agenda. So they could always, you know, send somebody back later or whatever.
I guess. I guess in a way, because we should remember that although they may be fighting this war against Division 3, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're out-and-out heroes themselves. I mean, they're trying to protect their own kind to a certain degree. Because otherwise, they're leaving this guy in a cell where pretty much everyone else has been killed. So it's kind of a strange thought. But yeah, he is acting quite bizarre. So, you know, maybe he deserves it. I don't know. Now, later, when you see that Carrie Loudermilk, that he literally takes on the bruises and pain from his sister to help her. Does he do that? Is it helping her heal? Or does he actually absorb it all entirely into himself? Because I get the impression, well, maybe it's both, actually, I guess. I think he helps her heal, but I think he takes on all of her pain and her bruises himself so that when she pops out later, I think she's completely healed. Is that how it looked to you? Is that how it goes?
Yeah, I think that's what, I think they kind of indicated, or even said, like, something to that order. Because, like, he wasn't able to take her back, like when she was completely screwed up, because it would have been like too much for him to take, but so she had to heal a little bit, and he was able to take the rest.
That makes more sense. So it's very much these So in a way, Carrie Laudermilk at least has empathetic abilities where his sister's concerned. And again, this might have been mentioned last week, but who cares? We'll mention it again because it made me think of you and one of your favorite things. I love how the strobe light effects throughout the sequence in the Division 3 headquarters is so very Twin Peaks-ish. It's very David Lynch-like. David Lynch loves the strobe, or as well, and his stuff.
Yeah, they definitely, and as we saw this week too, they definitely don't mind having, paying homage to Twin Peaks in there.
Oh yeah, I actually tweeted that I think with this past episode they made Twin Peaks look like Melrose Place because they went so far off the reservation that I was like, oh, I hope there's a tether line to bring you back because it just got way weird. But back to last week, going off the fact that as Loudermilk says, the monster is another consciousness inside David, I think is what he's indicating. That's burrowed inside his brain when he was a child and has been feeding on him ever since. It's very interesting to really try to figure out the story behind the monster. We actually do get maybe the most confirmation about that in tonight's or today's, whatever, tonight's, today's, last night's episode, which we'll get to shortly. We talked about this a little bit, but the whole thing with David playing the banjo and singing, I guess it was Rainbow Connection. I think you had mentioned you thought like that was actually David, or the nor or the normal side of David or whatever. I think it's something like along those lines as well. I felt that may have been more representative of his childhood, of his innocence before the affliction really set in on him. And it's also worth noting that when he's singing and every that whole moment, he's never moving from that one spot. So it's as if he's rooted there, once again, like as if he's a prisoner, which we also see later on when he's pretty much there are several moments with David where he appears to be paralyzed, like he can't move from where he is or something. When he's with his sister later, who, by the way, I kept thinking in that scene when we first see his sister with him and she's totally normal and friendly and whatever, I kept thinking she should be a lot more horrified by what she undoubtedly saw when they were leaving the Division 3 headquarters. Because there's no way she couldn't have seen, dozens of dead bodies and dead body pieces all around her. But I can't believe I didn't make note of this last week. There's that moment where we see David looking at himself in the mirror and he's touching his face as though he's never seen such a reflection before. It even goes to the whole it wears a human mask kind of a moment. Did you notice that?
Yeah, it definitely, kind of seemed like somebody else was in the driver's seat and maybe a little bit more than usual.
Right. And it's also worth noting that that's the mirror that Lenny comes out of as well. And with all this business about people walking in and out of mirrors, which again happens in the latest episode, I can't believe I didn't mention it last week, but I got to mention it now. They're totally just going right to through the looking glass, the Alice in Wonderland concept here, which really works as far as Sid in the latest episode. But we'll get to that shortly, as I said. When David goes into that, for lack of a better way to put it, I call it his paralytic spaz mode. Do you think that when that happens, when he's kind of like, shimmering and shaking and he's trying to do something, do you think that maybe that's the normal side trying to fight back?
Yeah, that's also kind of like the assertion that I got. And that could be just based on, seeing that kind of thing before in various forms of media. So there could be kind of some kind of bias I have there. But it definitely seemed like they were trying to do that.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out if maybe it happens when the thing inside him is set free to roam outside, like we see later with Sid when the when what we've come to call the Shadow King is stalking around that house. Just a little aside, I really like how the music suddenly gets very Nine Inch Nails in the scene when Melanie mutely demands Carrie let Carrie come out. If you notice the soundtrack music from that point on, it sounds purely like Trent Reznor. So in a way, you could almost say it's almost like a David Fincher kind of a thing, but that's really very Nine Inch Nails. It's interesting as we get to the very end of the episode what David says when he says, "I can't stop her," and then he says, "me," right after that. So that was an interesting way to put that. You know, because obviously when he says, "I can't stop her," he's referring to Lenny, but "me" is like, oh, is he acknowledging it's part of him when he says that? It's a very telling odd use of words there.
Right. Of course, he also, I think he partially believes that he's schizophrenic too, so he might see that as like himself when he's being more coherent than usual instead of viewing it as some kind of like parasite, which I don't think he's clued into yet.
Right. That makes sense. And when we get to that final moment, have we determined who we believe creates that whole therapy session reality? I mean, I think we've come to believe it's David, especially because he looks like he's holding his head like he's about to lose it again, and that usually precedes him transporting people elsewhere. So, of course, I guess we'll get into this as we're about to talk about the episode. It's determining who created this reality, or are there more hands at work than just David's attempt to find a safe haven for them?
Yeah.
All right, well. As I sip a beverage, which is non-alcohol because it's so early in the morning, I think we can stop spinning our heads about chapter 5 because, oh Lord, we gotta start percolating our brains now about chapter 6 of Legion. Now, as I run down the details and deeds of this episode, of course, as always, feel free to interrupt for any conversational points. So it's just not me droning on and on to the break of dawn here, okay?
Yep.
So I love the fact that the description for this episode, if you're looking it up on your cable guide or IMDb or wherever else, it's simply David goes back to where it all started.
Yeah.
That's hysterical because, look, this episode hardly proceeds in so perfunctory a fashion, to put it mildly.
Right. Yeah.
So we begin the episode with a series of these one-on-one therapy sessions between Lenny, or maybe we should call her Dr. Busker for most of this episode. And pretty much most of the people that were caught in this web of this alternative reality. So you see her talking to Melanie about her husband, clearly pressing that Melanie should really get over it. She talks to Tanami about every single last detail of the morning his mother died. And Busker thinks he really dwells too much on that memory and in the past in general. I love that we even see her talking to the Loudermilks, which I feel like I can call them the Loudermilk twins. I'm going to from this point on. And even evil Walter or the Eye. But when she's with Sid, Sid is the only one who seems to question whether or not this is real, or maybe just some sort of a boring dream. And I think one should remember that Sid was the one questioning reality in chapter one as well. And this is one of many, many callbacks, or this episode is replete with callbacks and parallels to the first installment of Legion. It mirrors it in many different ways, I think.
Also, I think it's worth it to note that of all these characters, Sid is the only one that knows that David can like, create some kind of like, inner reality for them to hang out in. So subconsciously she, knows that, and that might be part of why like her mind's resisting what's going on, because she like knows that it can be fake.
Yes, that does make a lot of sense. Because not just it's not just being aware of it the way, say, Melanie might be, or even Tommy. She's experienced it. She's been within it. So that would definitely have leave much more of an imprint on her than just being told about something.
Right.
It's interesting. One can't help but notice that when she walks down the corridors later, and just by the way she looks around, it's just the fact that there are doors again. Because these are the Carters that lost their doors, if we remember what happened at Clockworks back in the first episode. But there is one additional door that's not like all the others. But as Sid is about to press her ear against that door, she's summoned to the nurse's station. And then she's kind of given the worst TSA treatment of all time by let's call her Nurse Amy. Because in this alternate reality, David's sister is pretty much like a sinister Nurse Ratched or something
Huh,
like
yeah.
that. Which, you know what? I bet the actress had fun with because since she had to play someone who was kind of weepy and sniveling for the last couple episodes, so now she gets to play a real nasty, strong character. So I'm sure
Yeah.
the actress got a big kick out of that. Now, speaking of callbacks, now we see that David and Tonami are watching a catatonic Rudy drool one of those excessively long lines of unbreaking spittle, which is just the way David, and I think it was Lenny, did in chapter one. I think it had to be Lenny, because that was before David officially met Sid. Yeah, it's David and Lenny, if I recall. And then when David himself is having his one-on-one with Lenny, or Dr. Busker, who I should point out is using the exact same office that Dr. Kissinger had in chapter one, right down to that blurry screaming photo on the wall. You notice that David seems a lot more like his original self, maybe even slightly more at peace, or maybe he's just more resigned to his fate, which may be what the evil forces, either within or without, would want him to be. But it's in this moment when he's discussing his own condition. This is how we know there's something else off with David, because he's talking about being a manic depressive and trying to keep the balance to avoid that scary mania side down. Now, one can make the case that powers or not, David has some serious mental issues. Manic depression is not one of them. So if anyone paying attention, that should have been like, wait, what? That's not his issue. That's a different kind of an issue.
Yeah, I definitely thought there was some deflection going on there. Kind of, keep him so he wasn't focused on what was actually going on.
Yeah, it's kind of like creating his own distraction. Or as I will probably say later in this little recappy thing, it's one of another instance of David trying to rewrite his own history, his own memory, so to speak, his own reality, I guess. Now, oh, because we were mentioning Twin Peaks just a few moments ago, hey, the moment with the pie in the cafeteria, that's got to be a wink to Agent Cooper's favorite diner weakness from Twin Peaks. I mean, pie? Especially cherry pie. I always
Well,
think
yeah,
of it as a cherry pie.
cherry pie, and the way they shoot the food to make it look creepy, even when there isn't bugs crawling over it, they still make it look just so that, creepy food camera work that they love to do on Twin Peaks for some fucking reason. So.
Oh, that weird moment where they zoom in for a close-up on the cherry pie filling, and I think we see Lenny floating in there briefly, which they're having so much fun with the visuals on the show. It's amazing. But also, as far as those bugs were concerned, that horrifying moment when Sid realized there are bugs infesting her fruit-filled pastry. Of course, that's also a reminder of that bowl of buggy fruit from the White Room. It's another reminder that here, just like there, that evil isn't completely hidden from view. And it doesn't just simply lurk, it infects and it infests, much like it's done to David, and much like it's continuing to do in this alternate reality here as well.
I wonder if the bugs are actually like a sign of like the good part of David trying to like chip away at the reality. Because like if the white room that Sid and David were banging in was possibly created by the Shadow King, and then this is also possibly he's definitely seems to be in control of what's going on here in this version of Clockworks. Maybe the bugs are some kind of like actually like a good thing instead of like creepy, kind of like like something that would wake you up from a dream type thing.
It would be a rather horrifying manifestation if something could, but it would certainly be
Yeah.
a spin on that. This is now followed by something I'm not really sure how to describe it. Okay, it basically it's followed by a musical sequence with Lenny. It's done to the tune of the Nina Simone song, the "I Feel Good." It plays like it could be a really nifty James Bond opening credit sequence, quite frankly.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely like a Bond Saul Bass type thing there. It just bonkers. It's so sweet to have this show up in the middle of an episode.
More so than the musical number we got in once back to chapter one, this was even almost more of a head scratcher, because that what happened in chapter one is that was definitely a almost that Bollywood kind of thing, but it was almost done for David's benefit. Like it was his imagination taking over, whatever. This, it kind of plays like it's being done for the viewer. It's as opposed to any specific characters on the show. But once again, and I think it's going to become a running thing we're going to say on this podcast until we're done talking about Legion. It underscores the astonishingly vivid job that Aubrey Plaza is doing,
Oh.
and she's shredding it up every week on this show. It's
Yeah.
bonkers, is putting it mildly for her. Again, this is the girl from Parks and Rec, really? Wow, she's everything. And if we
And
are
definitely
gonna,
not dry. Definitely not dry in this show. And she definitely, yeah,
no.
she's completely all over this, like, credit sequence type goofiness. I mean, she definitely, she wasn't fucking around there. She was just, jumping and grinding and doing everything. It was pretty sweet.
And if we are going to note anything more detail oriented that may play into the story as far as the sequence is concerned, we should point out that what she's doing, she's cavorting around the locales of pretty much all of David's past memories and even places where he re-experienced some of them at Summerland. So it's like she's basically dancing around his mind to a certain extent, which is kind of bizarre, but really it does make sense the more I think about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if did we see her show up in, like, Child David's bedroom during the sequence or not?
I
'Cause
thought we did. I thought we did.
yeah.
I thought she does walk. I mean, she walks through all the other rooms, or we see, or if we either, I think it's things that she actually walks through, or we see flashes and these little weird smears around her, where we see memories of him and Lenny together, or different moments.
Yeah,
It's.
when you do your rewatch, I'm not sure if I'll get around to it, but you'll have to keep an eye out for me because I'm just kind of wondering if, like, the Child David's bedroom is kind of like, akin to Oliver's Ice Cube thing, and it's just kind of like, his place where he can go and try to keep out the darkness or keep himself in check or whatever. So if she doesn't prance through there, there might be some merit to that assumption.
Okay, I will keep an eye out for it. Not sure if that place would qualify, because I feel like there have been some screwy things that have happened in that room, but maybe it's still where he goes to because it's his childhood room, which is why
Yeah.
maybe Sid shows up in it at the end of the episode. Spoiler. Anyway. So speaking of Sid and memories, we do see that when Sid is dreaming, her subconscious unearths the memories of what we Let's just say what we assume our reality. And then, and while she's sleeping, we do get another moment that mirrors the pilot once again. We see her door opening, but no feet enter the room. But suddenly, there's David standing over her. It's basically the exact opposite of what happened in the pilot, which was Sid standing over David while he was sleeping. So I thought it was cute that they did a call back to that. Especially something that I took so much time to note in our earlier podcast. It's like, where are the feet? Where are the feet? I don't understand. But here, she's talking about her thoughts, her dreams, her feelings, that there's something wrong, that it's like deja vu, but different. And then a couple things happen that I think are noteworthy. Because as David's talking to her, as he responds, it's very clear, at least to me, that he's kind of retreated to Clockworks. It looks like he sees this place that he was essentially, not just a patient, but almost a prisoner for years. It is that safe haven for him because the outside world is too much, it's too loud. So I feel like David here is, again, he's falling into a more passive role, and Sid is the more aggressive side, which is really interesting for a person who can't be touched, I think. But it's an interesting dynamic since David is, the quote unquote main character on this series, but Sid has been driving the story a lot more over the last couple chapters, I feel.
Right, yeah, it's been cool to see.
And also, the other thing that's I think was really a nice little touch, I don't know if I'd call it subtle or not, don't matter. Did you notice that when David is towards the end of this moment, when he's recounting his session with the doctor? He first says Lenny, and then he corrects himself and says Dr. Busker. And right when he does that, the scene, which had been silent up until that point, suddenly menacing music starts to play in the background when he makes that correction. If you missed it, I would say go check that out. It's a nice little horror touch that, but I really enjoyed that. Anyway, I ramble. So later, when Sid heads to what I guess we would call the day room, she notices that odd door is no longer there, which, you know, like I said, it's a very Alice in Wonderland kind of vibe there. She hangs out with those checker-playing Loudermilks who are exercising their brains by naming different drugs in alphabetical order. They all get into a dream conversation. You know, Sid apparently has some hazy but unclear memory of the moment when the eye disguised as Rudy tries to shoot David. And how sad is Rudy? Rudy gets hardly any face time on this show. It's like I wouldn't even know his name was Rudy if not for the fact that a couple of people mentioned it at some point. It's probably like the one undeveloped character I think on the show, quite frankly. Carrie apparently is dreaming of giant ice cubes, and we know what that means. And the rather sad Melanie is dreaming of love. Now we never hear what it is that Carrie dreams of, because it cuts away from that. Although we do end up spending a lot more time with the Loudermilk twins here, even as we notice that the eye is keeping an eye on her. It's as if this version of him is maintaining that weird connection to her because he shot her at the end of chapter 4. Now, I notice that before they separate, the twins kind of fist bump each other goodbye, which looked like it was almost like a little Wonder Twin Powers activate kind of a wink, I thought. Which was especially kind of ironic if you know your super friends, because then moments later, you know, Carrie then sees a giant glowing ice cube floating above him. And next thing you know, he is transported to that astral plane where he encounters the silent diver, who I think we can only assume is still Oliver. Now, if we believe, and I think we do, that David's imagination is what created this place, much the way he made that white room, then, you know, the fact that within this reality he can also paint is probably kind of pretty small potatoes. Did you notice that the painting he's doing of Sid, you know, that one of her eyes has remained blank? So it's almost like, you know, looking a little bit like Walter or the eye himself. Which then reminds us of that moment when they switch places and you saw that one of her eyes kind of graze over, like with a cataract or something. So it's during that conversation and during the painting scene between David and Sid, this is when we really discover that David believes the reasons for their respective mental hospital commitments are far different than what they were originally. You know, like we've mentioned before, he thinks that he's manic depressive as opposed to schizophrenic. But what's even more telling or more bizarre in the scene is that he thinks that Sid suffers from delusions rather than the antisocial disorder that she talks about, you know, the whole "you people can't touch me" thing. I think it's as if he's kind of been programmed, whether it be by himself or however you want to phrase it, to not believe anything Sid might tell him because maybe she's perceived as being, you know, he's going to perceive her as potentially giving into her delusions and fantasy. But it's almost like the evil presence in him, or whatever you want to call it, this is kind of a safeguard against the truth or against reality by creating a situation where he's going to not necessarily believe what she says. Did that strike you that way during that part?
Yeah, it's there's definitely something in that order going on here. It's just hard to know what I mean. This show is just so fucking crazy. It's I mean it's These are the kind of things we have to think about that are so much more complex, and there's so many different options, more so than we're used to having to do with the straightforward shows that we tend to podcast. So I don't know, just really something.
Yeah, it's interesting because if we look at this episode and what's been going on, that whether we want to call the Shadow King part of David or not, whether it's something that did exist at one point in the universe before David and then found its way into him, or it's something that's always just been simply part of David from the get-go. And I think very compelling cases can be made either way, regardless of anything anyone says on the show, because just because someone says something doesn't necessarily make it so, right?
Yeah, just because Lenny, indicates that, that Shadow King is some kind of like external presence that showed up and just is just, you know, like a passenger doing this kind of stuff and then decided to hang out. I mean, you really can't trust anything that that character says or what most of the characters say. So
right, you can never be 100% sure. You can just guess which one you want to go and see where it takes you, but then you may end up backtracking or talking about the previous episode, and you're like, oh, maybe it's this way or maybe it's that way. But the interesting thing so far with this episode, and because if it's targeting David, if this is about all about David, but it's interesting as you watch as this episode unfolds, once again, it feels like Sid feels like the more almost intended victim or the threat more than David does to this throughout this episode. Because, like, after this scene, I mean, she's more troubled than she even was before. Sid leaves, and that's when she comes across that weird beating, swelling mass in the wall. It's almost like a heart or something that literally bleeds. And then she has that flash of Lenny being trapped in the wall. And which then, you know, again, then we get, you know, the editor, you know, pulling double time here. We get a virtual cacophony of images of pretty much everything that's happened over the first 5 episodes of Legion. But then Lenny appears, and it's like Lenny is there to try to neutralize her. And he puts she puts those headphones on Sid, and the music is the familiar nighttime song of crickets. And from this point on, that sends Sid, I wouldn't say she goes into a trance. I think she actually enters another state of consciousness, which may or may not be the same thing, depending how you want to, what kind of words you like to use. But she literally floats back to bed.
I wonder if the one of the reasons besides the, you know, the like relationship angle, one of the reasons that like Lenny is treating Sid like such a threat is because when her and David initially switch places, like her first reaction like was to like throw Lenny into a fucking wall. So like maybe like Sid just like instinctively like recognizes that character, presence, entity, whatever, as a threat, and like, you know, dealt with it so harshly instantly. So maybe there could be something there.
I think that's a great observation. It's not. Although it could be read as just almost pure jealousy, but yeah, the fact that I don't know if we can really ascribe gender to the whole Shadow King thing, because it seems to manifest in any number of ways. Lenny is just one of its faces, so to speak. It's also a dog. It's also a paper mache boy. You know, it's a he, a she, and an it. It's really, you could just spend a podcast just trying to figure that out, I think. And the sequence, we continue to hear the crickets chirping, but then we get a little bit more insight into, you know, and reminder that there's other people in this episode. We see Tanami in his dreams, or he's continuing to dream about the memory of his mother's passing. But I notice that we are once again denied seeing Carrie's dream. And then it occurred to me in that moment, she had said in a previous episode, when she was discussing the symbiotic relationship between her and her brother, and correct me if I'm wrong, one of the things she mentioned is that she never gets to sleep or eat. I think sleep is one of the things she says she doesn't do, which she considers like the boring stuff. So in a way, the fact that we keep seeing Carrie either going to bed or waking up, but we never actually see her dreaming or sleeping, in a weird way kind of makes sense, because technically, I think she said she's never slept before. I'm pretty sure that's what she said.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So, you know, she does get out of bed to look for Carrie, who we know is now traipsed off to the astral plane. But then the eye shows up. And, you know, this could have just been purely the Lenny is the evil psychotic thing that's creepy throughout the whole episode, as long as with Nurse Amy. But, the eye, who we initially believe, oh, he's kind of trapped there just like the rest of them, and he kind of is, but he's as bad, if not worse, than he was before. So he goes into, he's almost as unsettling as the scene from the previous episode with the Shadow King stalking Sid around that bedroom, the way he's kind of essentially stalking Carrie. He even gets to have a weird line like, "Did you ever eat an animal that was still living?" or something. So, Carrie, who clearly has kind of lost her mojo in this alternate reality, she's not the kick-ass Carrie that we're used to seeing. She runs away, and the eye ends up slowly stalking her down the corridors. It very much plays like something out of an 80s slasher film. He may as well be wearing a William Shatner or a hockey mask or something at this point. Now, as we're getting to the final act of the episode, David, who up until now hasn't questioned anything and has been really dismissive of any thoughts to the contrary, I think that's when he sees the door that Sid was talking about. And then evil nurse Amy appears, and she, how do we describe what she taught? Let's say that she cruelly mocks him about how people feel about or how he's unloved, and the whole weird thing about the puking. And I was, did you think she was actually going to puke for a moment there? That we were actually going to see something like shoot out of her mouth? Because I have to admit, I thought they were going to go that far for a second there.
Yeah, so did I. I got to the point where I was like, man, what, how the hell are they gonna have that be, make that visual? Like, what's it gonna look like? But they did not go that route. It's
They
probably
did,
fortunate for some viewers.
but you know what? I want to give them credit for something that we don't actually tend to see very often in, at least in live action. The fact that that moment where she's trying to make her, it looks like she's trying to put on a thing where she's going to puke or make herself sick, that it for just for a moment it starts to have an effect on David, like it makes him look like he wants to throw up, then he has to get away. Because isn't that that classic thing where, no, if you blow chunks and I'm going to have to hurl and you know. You don't usually, other than like a Wayne's World sketch, you don't usually see that. So I thought that was really funny. So then we finally switch to Melanie, who has been up until this point rather spacey in the episode. She's tending to some rather miraculous flowers, quite frankly, and the diver appears. Now, she speaks to him as though, you know, it definitely is her husband, and that's when it takes a much more bizarre turn than I thought they were going to take, because she's able to follow him through the wall. And when she steps out, she actually, again, walks through a mirror. So there's that through the looking glass thing yet again. And when she comes out, she's back in that room where the bullets had just started to fly towards David and Sid. Now, everything in the room is in that super slow-mo. And so for folks like me and you who will watch a show like The Flash, or even remember like the X-Men movies and how they dealt with the Quicksilver character, you keep expecting some speeds to show up and like, you know, try to pluck those bullets out of the air or something. Because when Melanie tries to do it, apparently they're sizzling hot. She can't really touch the bullets. Although I would say pick something up in the room and just knock them down with her.
Yeah, hit it with your shoe.
Your shoe or something. But she can't, not only can't she move the bullets from the air that are, you know, slowly spinning their way towards Sid and David, she can't budge Sid and David either. Now I'm thinking, you know, is there a wardrobe in the corner you can like push in front of them or something? But then we get one of the more striking and what images in the series for me, quite frankly. When Lenny's big ol' eyes appear in the room, it's like something out of some sort of Dolly-inspired Twilight Zone episode where the eyes are like on either side of the doorway or something. It totally had, and the way her eyes are, because Aubrey Plaza has very, she's got some distinct peepers there, people. But it totally had that total room for one more kind of vibe, you know, for classic Twilight Zone fans. Now, back at Clockworks, I hear my little phone ringing over here, so please ignore that. Back at Clockworks, David pops in on Dr. Busker because he can't find Sid, which leads Dr. Lenny Busker to question if Sid is really the right girl for David. And while before we can say that Lenny sounded just like a malevolent doctor, she starts to sound more like a patient here, to put it mildly. She compares love to a fungus that infects ants. And she believes that the only point to life isn't really love, it's power. something that she notes that Walter, aka the Eye, can certainly understand. And you wonder if perhaps sensing that David is slowly finding his way back, even if it's the very early stages, that's when Lenny goes into full-tilt parasitic creepy mode. She even briefly does become the Shadow King when she reveals how she actually, or she claims, that she actually knew David's real father, and how he thought he could hide David from her. Since it's Lenny speaking, I'll stick with her, although, you know, like we just said, it could be a him or an it or whatever. But we learn more when she says she first thought she would just poison David and move on years ago, but the power that he wielded, and she had the thought that if they combined, they could even take on God. So it's kind of a really interesting scene, and it's kind of like what we were talking about, like, how much do we choose to believe, and how much do we wonder, is she just messing with him? I wonder if she, because to a certain degree, I wonder if she would be messing with him, because she doesn't need to be telling him any of this, quite frankly. He's, considering how much denial he's been in to begin with, so I'm very unsure about it. I mean, I'm inclined to think that what she's saying is probably, at the very least, mostly true, but there's probably obviously a lot more to it than that, I think.
Right.
Oh, let's just finish, and I might as well just finish the episode. At the end, we find Sid is asleep with those crickety headphones on, and as we mentioned before, she's actually in David's childhood bed, but she's awoken by the diver, who turns out to be Carrie Loudermilk. And if I'm not mistaken, that's how the episode ends. And this was a rather dizzying, and I'll use a phrase that you like to, a word you like to use in other podcasts, a dizzying and disjointedly odd episode of Legion.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that was pretty cool. And I, after watching the episode, I listened to cricket music when I or you know sounds when I went to sleep myself, just for the hell of it. I've got these apps where I can, you know, program all these nature sounds, you know, like rain and wind and whatever. And so I just went full cricket last night.
Wow. I don't know if I would do that. I think I might have very bad dreams. I've had one or two that I'd like to connect to the show. And it's not the dream I want to have because, you know, Sid. But anyway, it's interesting how every successive episode of the show does or tackles something just a little bit differently than the previous one. And, you know, you can say the show has gotten more bizarre, more crazy as it's gone on. You know, that's, I guess that's a matter of opinion, whatever. It does get harder to try to determine, oh, is this one, you know, better than the previous week, or is it a step down, whatever. I mean, there are definitely things I thought were great about this episode. I really like the episode. Don't get me wrong. There is part of me, however, that will say part of me didn't want the entire episode to be devoted to this, if that makes any sense. Part of me, yeah. I think part of me wanted them to deal with the situation and be able to get out of it at least by the final act, if not earlier. Because we're dealing with a show that's only 8 episodes. So, I mean, I love the trip, and I love the performances, but I think I would probably put it a notch or two below the last couple, especially like the last two, I think. But there's still a lot to chew on here and to talk about, of course. But I just because I like to make it clear that I'm just not going to fawn over something, like you know, the way we used to talk about things like Mad Men or Better Call Saul, you know, I just want to point out if there's a flaw here, it's just I think this could have been done in maybe the first 45 minutes and then get out of it. So I'm curious how much time they'll spend in the next episode finding their way out of it. Cause I assume that's going to freaking happen, because if they spend 2 episodes here, I'm gonna call up Mr. Noah myself. Like, hey, dude, what are you doing? Anyway.
Yeah, I can see why you'd have that reaction. I wasn't bothered by it. I thought it was kind of fun that, like, you know, all the characters are pretty much frozen in time, and they spent like an entire episode just like, and they're still frozen in time. Like, the story hasn't progressed. I mean, they've revealed a few bits of information here and there potentially, and there's plenty of stuff going on. But I just thought it was kind of, you know, a little audacious that they you know, that they did that. It didn't feel like, you know, it didn't leave me kind of feeling like they're just fucking with us and just you know, being so, like, you know, certain times, like back watching Lost when they had the episode The Other 48 Days, so, like, you know, the week before there's like this big cliffhanger, and then the whole next week is just like nothing progresses, and it kind of had that, like, you know, that impression, just like, oh, they're just, you know, fucking with us, they're gonna make you wait a whole another week. It didn't feel like that at all to me. But that was also the fact that they picked it up for a second season. It lets me be a little bit more patient, so they don't need to resolve a bunch of stuff in the next 2 weeks. So, but I definitely see what you and, you know, Seven Walls said something similar about that episode.
Have I read? I don't think I got a chance to read this thing yet. Oh, by the way, I love the other 48 Days episode. So
I think it's great.
People who complain about that is like, I just want to smack them. Yeah. There's so much you can complain about with Lost, especially in the final season. But people who complain about season two, I'm like, shut up. The only problem with season two of Lost is they take a little while to get to the point in the first few episodes. They get a little bit too cute for, you know, this, you know, to get back to where, to pick up where things left off. But after that, people complain about it, and I don't care. I don't care that, oh, we kill off almost all the characters. Spoiler. I don't care, because I got a great season of television. I don't understand people who have issues with that season. I'm one of the few people who will even make the case that I like season two better than season one. I know everyone's like, you know what? Ben Linus, there. That's all I need. Boom, yeah. Whatever.
And the Lenny of Lost, Ben Linus.
Yes. Wow.
Of course, Lost already has a Lenny, but still, the Legion's Lenny of Lost.
Wow, you're remembering me. That's also how I refer to my mother, by the way. Anyway, so let's get into thoughts about this episode. So, like, I think I already said that, or we're speculating that this Clockworks scenario is pretty much all David's doing. You know, it's kind of where he went as kind of a safe place, because that's where he fell in love with Sid and so on.
Yeah, but the coping mechanism.
But what's interesting is, I think he's responsible for it to that extent, but he can't control the variable of the Shadow King and how that evil still seeps in and infects the entire premise. And I also thought he couldn't foresee that what transporting all these other people to this, you know, this other reality would do, not just to his mind, but what it does to theirs. So, you know, I don't think he takes any of that into consideration, or just doesn't realize how it's going to impact all these people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, having the Shadow King / Lenny of being able to control this, you know, this reality. I mean, just like the entire episode was just watching Lenny, like, basically neuter, like, all the characters and, you know, whatever, you know, little trickery had to be done. So it's definitely cool, you know.
It's also worth noting that in this reality, I'm just pulling stuff out of my butt here, that the Eye seems to be like the way he was before, if even worse, which, because he'd probably be on Team Shadow King anyway, you know, because, you know, evil. But it's interesting how it deals with what it would perceive as threats. Like, it clearly sees Sid as a threat, for, you know, based on its previous experiences you pointed out before. So it's really targeting her, much the way Lenny did late in the previous chapter as well. But do you notice things like for most of the episode, Melanie seems to be the biggest space cadet there, you know, and who is the leader of the opposition. Rudy, who, you know, doesn't really get much screen time, but the one thing we know about Rudy is he's really powerful.
Yeah.
He's a drugged up drooling mess. So he's really neutralized. And Tanami just doesn't even remember what he was.
No.
You know, which is kind of interesting, because
it's kind of interesting because he's like trapped in like one memory. Well, you know, normally he's the one that's like going through other people's memories and helping him sort shit out. But in this case, he's just locked into just one, and, you know, just, you know, completely immobilized.
There's something he says that's really interesting during his friendly conversation with David, which is probably more friendly than any conversation they had in the first five episodes, quite frankly. There's a line that goes something like, "There is no before once the sickness starts." And it's a notable line from a character, like we were just saying, he's a person, his abilities were digging into and revisiting people's memories. And it's like he's been robbed of that memory and thus the knowledge of his own powers. And so that's why he just keeps going back to that one same memory of the loss of his mother over and over again, you know, even if it's just in his dreams, I guess.
Plus, Lenny's using the characters that aren't a member of the quote unquote team to kind of like keep some of the other members at bay, so like the eye is kind of helping keep the two Carries separated, and Nurse Amy is just basically going around just fucking with everybody else. So I think that's kind of interesting too, that kind of using them as tools to keep the other ones from, I guess, from getting together and being at their best also.
It's also worth noting that we even heard Loudermilk say in a previous episode about the creature, the Shadow King, as we're calling it, rewriting David's memories, when in fact, as we watch this episode, that's kind of what David is doing. You know, like the whole changing his mental diagnosis of him and Sid, not to mention God knows what else in this scenario. This is David's doing right now, I think. As far as that's concerned, I mean, at least.
It was. I did kind of also find it to be fun, like the way that they were framing some of these characters during their like being analyzed scenes. Where I mean, you got Melanie as like the dreamer, and you got the two Loudermilks as some like creepy couple, like an 18-year-old and like a 70-year-old, and then just kind of frame him like like they were some kind of like weird relationship type thing. So I just I thought it was cute, but kind of just a fun way to do it.
It's also interesting when you get moments like someone like Tanami, who's not we've not seen beyond the receiving end of anything like this before. So what I liked about the stuff with him is it kind of humanized him a bit more than we had seen him in the first five episodes. I don't know if we felt anything remotely like sympathy for him before. He did have like one good line or two that was telling in a previous episode when he's arguing with I think Melanie, when he says what, or Melanie, or is it Melanie or Sid? I think it's Melanie. When he says, you think I don't have a sister? 'Cause he makes a reference to the fact that everyone's had stuff to sacrifice, or people that they've lost, and that was the first indication of anything like that with him. And then when we see the memory of his mother dying in front of him, and the whole story of how that happened, it's pretty powerful for a character that we hadn't gotten to know quite that well before. So I just like that we that it, so here's like what you were saying before, a show or an episode that maybe outside of a little bit of information about the creature, the Shadow King, Lenny, whatever we want to call it, doesn't progress the plot very much, but at least it gave us a little bit of character for some that we hadn't gotten before, and we got some, you know, and we did get a lot of fun with Bill Irwin too. Bill Irwin is a lot of fun in this episode, it should be pointed out.
Yeah, just kind of like a fun take on a flashback episode. Because yeah, like you said, I mean, there's literally no plot progression. Like all the characters are still frozen in time, essentially. So I mean, nothing has changed between 2 weeks. In real world, assuming that is the real world, we're not just seeing some big, crazy like David at war with himself thing. But
they might as well all be in diver outfits in a cryogenic chamber somewhere,
yeah.
the way they're frozen.
Speaking of which, what do you think is going on with that? Do you think like Oliver is like reaching out and trying to like guide them out of this crap, or they're just like and
Yes,
then
that's I mean that I definitely think that is I think there's no question that is Oliver and it earlier on in the episode, and him I think reaching out to Carrie Loudermilk makes a certain amount of sense because he still seems to be in possession of his faculties and his obviously genius level intelligence, as we see throughout the episode when they're talking. So he might be the best person to guide through, as opposed to people like, say, Melanie or Tanami, who are kind of more caught up in whatever emotional state that they're in this reality. So is it what makes you curious is with Oliver being in that astral plane, right? And the reality of his own making. But the way he pops up here, so is he always aware of what goes on everywhere else? Does he have almost an, does he have the ability to be almost omniscient and just appear or be able to see things? That's interesting. I have never really thought about it, but I got the impression here, because this isn't like the modern day, present day world. This is yet another reality, and he's able to view that. So, in a weird way, you start thinking Oliver may be really, really powerful if he can pretty much appear anywhere. You know, wherever they've created this kind of a situation, if that makes any sense.
And I suppose maybe David's visiting him on the astral plane, might have reactivated him a little bit, so that's why he's playing more of a role in what's going on now, as opposed to what he was doing before. He's just chilling in his cool 70s ice cube.
Right, and also it even goes back to your theory from last week that if in fact David is, the son of Oliver and Melanie, and I still think that's a great theory. I'm hoping it comes true, and screw the comic book origins that he's actually Professor X's kid. Although then I read somewhere Patrick Stewart would love to show up on Legion. I was like, you know what? I don't want them to cross over with the movies. But if it gets me Patrick Stewart on this show, I'll be okay with I'd be okay with that. But it's not gonna happen. Trying to think if there's anything else I want to finish up with here before we call it a day or a night or whatever we want to call it for the end of this podcast. Oh, let's just get right to the very end. When Lenny says to David that we've known each other since the womb, I was thinking about it could be taken a few ways. And it all goes back to the whether we believe this to be something that existed outside externally or not. Do we think that the parasite attached itself to David while he was still in utero? Or is that more of an indication that this was always all part of David, and this is all his own making? That's always been part of him, that it might have laid dormant for some time, but it was always part of him. I know.
And this could be something too, where like if Oliver is similarly powered and does end up being David's father, this could be something that like had been some kind of being that had been plaguing him too, and then ended up being passed down like in some weird way when David was conceived, which would
So,
be
yes.
horrifying and creepy too. If there was that was some kind of enemy of his that managed to like do that, that would just be awful.
Well, it's interesting is that we're dealing with characters who are, as they even say themselves, they're supposed to be mutants. So it'd be interesting that something that would be in of itself some sort of an additional genetic mutation, I guess, or for lack of a better way to put it, would then wouldn't even skip a generation, would just go right on to the next generation. Again, going with the idea or concept that Oliver could actually be David's father. It's one of those things that just knowing now that we're getting another season, I'm pretty sure we're not going to get the answers to these things by the time the season is over. I would be legitimately shocked if we did, but hopefully we'll. It's like I don't necessarily want the answers to everything. I wouldn't mind a few, but I love just trying to spin things in my own head and trying to figure it out myself. I mean, this is a show that we've watched 6 episodes, and you can't even be sure when it takes place, much less anything else. I love that people are no matter where I look online, is this show in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s? I'm not sure. It's like, well, if Tanami's mother died when she was listening to 99 Luftballoons, that gives you a frame of reference for time. That's actually one of the first things that really locks that in, other than the fact that Oliver, they say that he's been in that reality thing for 21 years, and he's clearly locked in, to some point in the early 70s at best. But to me, that's kind of telling me, wait, is this show in the 90s? But then, no, it can't be, because 99 Luftballoons, I think, came out. I want to say mid 80s, like 80, I want to say 84, 85. I'm not positive about that. It wasn't earlier than 83. I'm thinking between 83 and 85. And they showed Tanami as a kid. How old is, did he even say how old he is when his mother dies? I don't remember if he says how old he is. Let's say he's 10. I don't know. He's clearly at least, he's supposed to be, I'm guessing, at least in his mid to late 20s here. I think that it's safe to say. So I'm thinking his mother died at least 15 years earlier, if not more. So it still could be the 90s, actually. Actually could be. I didn't even mean to go down that road, but I think we just figured out the show might be taking place in the mid to late 90s. I don't know. I could be totally wrong
It's
about
interesting.
that.
Yeah, it's interesting that this episode where they kind of threw on the brakes and just slowed things down, which I guess is what throwing on the brakes does.
I would hope so.
It'll end up being for one thing, like the longest we've talked about this show. I mean, so I guess we ourselves have had time to think, and there's definitely more, probably more meat to this episode than we initially thought, since we seem to keep finding different things to talk about that are spinning out of this.
Yeah, I think this is the first time we've actually exceeded the hour length for the Legion podcast. So darn it! I'm so happy that we stayed under an hour. But you know what? We're wrapping up right now, so it's not so bad. And we had a lot to talk about, so that's what's even better. So let's wrap it up then. If you enjoyed this podcast, you'd probably enjoy our Facebook page as well. You can find us on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Type that in, like the page, and join the conversation about shows like Legion and many others. You can find us on iTunes the very same way. Type in the Serious TV Drama Podcast in iTunes. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. A shout out to all the people who do, every once in a blue moon, retweet our links. Because they can follow us, they do follow us on the Twitter, and you can as well. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's at STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. And that's pretty much it for the Legion podcast this week. That was a lot of a fun episode and a fun conversation with you, as always, Mr. Dan.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you a week from now about the penultimate episode of the thankfully first but not only season of Legion. So I'm looking forward to see what kind of tricks that they have up their sleeve here.
Absolutely. I'm hoping that I didn't read the full article about the renewal. Actually, I think I read it. I just don't remember because my mind's been kind of a blur the last 24 hours. I'm hoping that they stick to the 8-episode format, actually. Because I think it just makes it nice for its
I read
episode.
It looking for that, but I didn't see anything. You know, if they bumped it up to 10 or something, that'd be fine. But I think 13 episodes of this show that kind of, it basically is like, it's like an anthology show with one plot in like the most like, fun way imaginable. So I think stretching that out to a longer half season would be a mistake.
No,
I'm sure they could handle it, but it's unnecessary.
Now, learn the lesson that the Marvel Netflix shows never have. Don't go to 13 episodes. Don't do it. Even the really good ones like, Luke Cage or Jessica Jones, or the ones that I'm not as big a fan of like Daredevil. Yeah, I just said it for that one listener. Don't care. there'll be a podcast where I get to talk about what my issues with Daredevil, but it ain't going to happen anytime soon. But the lesson learned is 10 is a nice number. 8's a fantastic number. It gives it, leave, like anything in life, leave you wanting more rather than, oh, I think you gave me too much.
Yeah.
That's why I love there are people complaining that the last two seasons of Game of Thrones are going to be like crazy short. It's like, dude, that means they'll be awesome. Shut up. Although I think they said the very final season will only be 6. Like, all right, 6 is a little, 6 is a little skimpy.
Yeah,
now we're getting into UK
sure
drama land.
Well, the last one will probably be like 3 hours long or something. So I think it'll be okay. Plus, the half season, the final season broke up into two halves. It tends to work out pretty well because I don't think Mad Men, Breaking Bad, even Hell on Wheels really suffered from that format. So I think be patient, you fucking people. It's fine. There's plenty of other stuff to watch in the interim.
Did they do that with BSG also? Sort of, kind of.
Oh yeah,
maybe,
yeah,
yeah. I thought, Everyone, calm down. Quite frankly, it's amazing with all the geeky fans we've known of different properties over the last 25, 30 years. Everything from Star Trek to Buffy to superhero stuff, whatever. Up until a couple years ago, I was like really impressed by Game of Thrones fans because usually they're like the book readers. How they kept their mouths shut and didn't spoil stuff and everything else. But, oh my God, over the last year or so, they've become, like, the whiniest fans. I'm sorry. they're whining about, oh, when's he going to write the book? Oh, he might die. When's the show coming back? Oh, we got to wait a few more months. Shut up. Just be quiet. You don't know what, you don't, first of all, you don't know what waiting for another season of an HBO show is like, apparently. Go ask a Sopranos fan what it was like to wait over 21 months for a new season. You know, have to wait an extra 2 months. Boo-hoo.
Yeah, so. If I can wait 25 years for fucking Twin Peaks, you can wait a couple fucking months. So chill out.
I like that we got all our cursing done, most of our cursing done in the final minute. As opposed to the All right, with that said, we just passed the hour 10 mark, so I'm going to say good day, sir.
Good day, sir. Have a good one. All right, later.